Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
The Guardian.
Hello, and welcome to the Guardian Books podcast with me, Sian Kane. On this week's show, we're going way, way back in time to the days of Homer's Iliad and Oedipal myth, all the while remaining very firmly in contemporary times. Later on, Claire will be talking to Daisy Johnson, who is nominated for the Man Booker Prize this year for her debut novel Everything Under, a reimagining of Sophocles in modern Britain. And Michael Hughes, whose new novel Country sees Homer's Iliad transported to Northern Ireland during the Troubles. But first of all, Claire is here, and we are also joined by The Guardian's chief culture writer and the generally wonderful Charlotte Higgins.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello,
it's a bit of a reunion for us, because Charlotte and I were most recently together in at the Edinburgh Festival.
Yes, and I feel like I kind of haven't seen you for a while as well, Claire.
We've been out and about, haven't we, Charlotte? We've been schmoozing.
We have.
You've been schmoozing.
I thought the last time I saw you was at our mutual Italian lesson.
Oh, well, I wasn't going to mention that. But that was just a bit too much information.
I'm not in Italian club. I'm not that cool. Well, Charlotte, let's talk about coincidence and whether it is coincidence. But at the moment, we've got Pat Barker's The Silence of the Girls, which is a retelling of Iliad. And Michael Hughes' Country, which again we mentioned before, is Iliad. Daisy Johnson's Everything Under, which is Oedipus. Camilla Shampsey's Homefire, which is a reimagining of Sophocles' Antigone. And The House of Names by Colm Tóibín last year, which riffed on Aeschylus and Euripides. So what's going on? Why are we all sort of going back to classical myth to write our contemporary novels?
I know, it's amazing, isn't it? Every time I hear of a new one, I think, gosh, isn't this over yet? You know, people still want to carry on doing this. I keep thinking it's reached peak Greek myth novelisation, and then it hasn't, which I'm delighted about, because, I mean, you could also add in there Madeline Miller's novel Circe, Zachary Mason's latest book, Metamorphica, Natalie Haynes' novel, Children of Jocasta. It's all go. My personal theory is that these old stories, which are very extreme, tell extraordinarily and profoundly kind of tragic stories about the effects of war or the extreme kind of collapse of a prosperous life, which is what happens to Oedipus. You know, he's the sort of great king, the great beloved and clever king whose life is completely reversed by the fact that he in the past unknowingly committed a terrible crime. The kind of extremity of these kind of stories seems to be right for our extreme times, and perhaps instead of confronting our extreme times directly, we want to do it via these old stories, which in fact is what the Greeks of classical Athens were doing when they wrote those great tragedies, because they were using the stories of the past, in a sense, the great myths of the past, to confront their own contemporary concerns.
One of the things that's really interesting about this is where the fiction writers are embracing tragedy. Then you have non-fiction writers like Edith Hall, who you chaired memorably at Hay, who are confronting the wisdom of the ancients and sort of almost in a sort of self-help way, or at least that's how it was received by the audiences at Hay.
Edith's book is fabulous, I have to say. It's a really humane and very accessible reading of Aristotle. And I say that, I mean, I studied classics, but I am a non-Aristotelian. I didn't study the Nicomachean Ethics or anything like that at university. Aristotle was a bit of a closed book to me. But Edith, who's an incredibly passionate thinker, she is incredibly attached to the thinking of Aristotle and makes this very compelling case in her book Aristotle's Way about how Aristotle can help us lead our lives. I mean, Aristotle is all about the formation of character, what it means to lead a good life, how a sense of fulfillment in our work and in our friendship and relationships leads us to a happy life. And she spoke about that at Hay you know, with such kind of vigour. She had everybody eating out of her hands.
This was 1,000 people in the middle of the day, in a field in the middle of Wales, Aristotle.
It was unbelievable. She had been programmed in a small venue at Hay, and we hadn't seen any of the signs that said, this event is now taking place in an absolutely humongous tent, the like of which you've never seen before. So we were kind of walked around, moving towards this enormous tent, and we looked at each other and swore quietly under our breaths. We couldn't believe that we were going to have to speak to all these people in this vast space. Anyway, after a moment, she was a little bit nervous backstage, but when she went on, she was just in full flow. She was absolutely fantastic. And yeah, I still can't quite unpick why 1,000 people on the Welsh-English border were so desperate to hear about Aristotle, but they were, and it was great.
I mean, does it sort of tie back to what you were saying before about the classical myths and why they're being reimagined again and again at the moment? Is it because we need a bit of distance?
We are wondering how to live our lives, aren't we? I mean, everything is in flux. I mean, maybe it's a not dissimilar thing from Noah Yuval Harari or something. We want to grasp onto these sources of wisdom. I think we are maybe generally, a lot of us are feeling a little bit lost, and grasping onto these guides seems good for the moment.
Interesting that you talk about being a little bit lost, because this is something that applies to the festivals themselves. I think that there's a sense that festivals, book festivals, there are so many of them all the way around the world, that they are now trying to find the next big thing. And one of those is challenging what the structure of events is. It's not just necessarily two people talking to each other. And this was instanced in your event for your own book, Charlotte, which was...
Yeah, talking about being a little bit lost.
Being a little bit lost.
Lost in the labyrinth.
That was a good segue, wasn't it? which is about mazes. And it's another coincidence, because there are three books about mazes that are coming out in the next... There they are. I've discovered a third. I know you think you only know two,
really?
Which is yours, Red Thread, and Henry Elliott's Follow the Thread, this thread. But there is also the Maze, a Labyrinthine Compendium, coming out in September, which I just popped into my inbox as it happened this week.
Crikey.
And your event was amazing, because there you go, there's another. I've come back from Edinburgh a bit hyper.
Dad jokes.
Because they didn't just talk to you about mazes, but they wrapped you in Red Thread, didn't they?
Oh, well, that was a bit different. I was wrapped in Red Thread for a photo shoot with a fantastic photographer who takes author pictures at Edinburgh, called Chris Close. And I've known Chris for some years, just because I've been reporting and writing about Edinburgh, and I've been a guest selector at the Edinburgh Festival. I've been an author at the Edinburgh Festival and a chair at the Edinburgh Festival, a little bit part of the furniture. Somehow, therefore, trusted Chris to take my photograph. He does get people doing sort of wonderfully mad things for his pictures. My book's called Red Thread. So I said, why don't we, when he said he wanted to take my picture, I said, why don't we do something with a red ball of wool? So I went to the pound shop and bought a ball of wool, red wool, thinking that Chris would do something mildly tasteful with it. But in fact, what he did was wrap my face in it so that I couldn't speak. Thanks, Chris. And I looked like kind of like Lee Bowery. It was slightly pervy, actually, in a peculiar way. Anyway, he wrapped my face in it and took these amazing pictures, and I was the object of pity and derision by all who passed by this photo shoot. So that was a slightly different thing. But in the event that I did, I was chaired by the festival director, Nick Barley, and he had this brilliant idea, although a slightly high-wire idea, that we should try and infuse something slightly labyrinthine into the event. He asked one of his colleagues, Julie Amphlett, who's the operations manager at Hay, to knit a red hat. And into the red knitted hat, he put words, and they were words that related to my book. So there were things like Crete and maze and web and fiction, or phrases like dead end. And I had to pick out words from the hat and talk about them just in the order that they came. And every time I picked out dead end, that was an audience question. I mean, it's interesting, because Nick's the festival director, so I think he himself is always looking for ways to think about how can we make it slightly different from someone coming on to talk about their book, or someone talking to someone else about their book. It was great fun, actually. It really was. It was really nice.
Well, speaking of great fun, I've been toiling away in the office, not going to Edinburgh, while the two of you have been larking about at the Edinburgh Book Festival this year. I haven't been able to go at all, and I'm incredibly bitter about it. I'm not going to hide it. I know. Well, what did you guys see? I'm really jealous.
Well, I just paid a lightning visit over one weekend, and I thought, what can I do that's coherent? Because the thing is, you arrive in these festivals, and it takes a bit of time to pick up the buzz, and in 3 days, it's just very difficult to know what's going to be exciting. So I decided to look at a strand called Playing with Books. And there were 7 shows altogether, 3 of them in partnership with the Lyceum Theatre, where they were actually reinventing for the stage works of fiction. And I actually only saw one of those, that particular strand. That was Ali Smith's How to Be Both, which I have to say was, I found absolutely thrilling.
Really?
No, they supposedly had 3 days of rehearsal.
They did have 3. They weren't making it up.
They had 3 days of rehearsal.
They'd had more time to do some writing and preparation, but they had rehearsed it only for 3 days.
Wow.
And it was extraordinary, but in that sense.
With a keyboardist playing the Renaissance artist, who is the centre of one section, and then 2 actors playing the mother and daughter. It's just such an amazing thing to do for a book, a completely different way of presenting literature, but very expensive. So it's not really, it's not scalable. That's the problem, is it? If you have to pay for rehearsal time for 3 actors plus 2 writers. And the whole point about literary festivals, and I suspect part of the reason for their success, is the Talking Heads format is incredibly economic.
Mm. In this case, it's a serendipitous thing, because it's a collaboration between the Edinburgh Book Festival and the Lyceum Theatre. So the presiding genius, aside from Nick Barley, the book festival director, is David Gregg, the artistic director of the Lyceum, which is just around the corner. So there's a nice sort of confluence of different disciplines, essentially. How to Be Both worked exceptionally well, and it's possible that they will take that forward and move towards making a full production. One of the things that was really nice about it is that the bothness of Ali Smith's novel is particularly suited to the stage, because there is this idea of bothness, you know, in performance. You know, you're both an actor, you're both yourself, and you are taking on the part, you're becoming somebody else. And that's, of course, that's just absolutely rooted in the very origins of theatre. So it worked. You know, that central metaphor for me kind of made the whole thing just perfect. You know, it was just absolutely ready to move to the stage. And I think Ali Smith was, I was sitting with her at the back of the venue, and she was so excited. Mm. She thought it was terrific.
It was a bit of an Ali Smith year, wasn't it? Because she also made an appearance with Nicola Sturgeon, being interviewed by the First Minister of Scotland. That's quite something.
Yeah, well, what was quite something about it was that Nicola Sturgeon was very good at it. I mean, you can tell when somebody's just been briefed so that they can just sort of get themselves through the next hour. No, I mean, Nicola Sturgeon clearly is a reader, and she's appeared with Val McDermott and other writers before, now at the festival. She was terribly good at it. And she did say rather brilliantly that she thought it should be compulsory for all political leaders to read fiction, as opposed to non-fiction, because of the extra, I suppose, because of the extra truthfulness, one might suggest, of fiction. You know, it's not just about the world, it's of the world. It speaks to a deeper truth often than mere reportage. And Ali Smith was also very impressive, as she very much tends to be. And she was yet even more impressive giving a lecture about Muriel Spark to celebrate the centenary of Muriel Spark's birth in Edinburgh.
She's sort of this, like, almost like a sort of the laureate of Scotland, isn't she, Muriel Spark? She's emerging as.
And rightly so. I've been waiting for this. I'm an absolutely paid up devotee of Muriel Spark. I read Loitering with Intent at least twice a year. It's the nearest I've got to a Bible.
I was about to say, which Muriel Spark would you recommend to someone that's coming to her for the first time? But I guess that might be your answer.
Well, my 17-year-old niece picked up The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, which is a good place to start. And then I actually gave her Girls of Slender Means, and I think I gave her possibly A Far Cry from Kensington. I'm going to work her up to Loitering with Intent.
Until she's at the point where she's reading it a couple of times a year.
And another of the Muriel Spark things this year was this staged reading of her unperformed play, Doctors of Philosophy, which you wrote about before it happened and also were at.
Yes, because in a spirit of Muriel Spark Completism, I had found that play on a well-known second-hand books platform last year because I was curious. I was just rereading Martin Stannard's biography of Spark and realised that I hadn't read this play, and I've read most of Muriel Spark. So I was very excited to read it, and I'm still not absolutely convinced, even by the terrific read-through, that it's a hugely successful play, but it is absolutely fascinating. It has five strong female characters, three male characters, all of whom are called Charlie. It's a kind of semi-satire on the intellectual class of 1962. It's called Doctors of Philosophy. It's set among this group of people, most of whom have PhDs. But the most sparky, in both senses, character is the cleaning lady, who's just called Mrs. S. And her job, she tells someone at some point, is polishing reality. So I think she is a little bit of a... She is a bit of a Mrs. Spark, because Mrs. Spark herself did not go to university, nor yet had a PhD. So you weren't convinced by it, Claire? That's
no,
my impression.
I wasn't. But I mean, I absolutely take the point that it's a really interesting thing. And there was a very large audience and they were very enthusiastic, because I think that there are probably a lot of Muriel Spark completists in Edinburgh, and more power to their elbow. But personally, I didn't find that was as exciting, because it was just a second-rate play, which... for me, which was being done in rehearsed reading, which didn't get the speed of that they would have had they had a bit more time. And as you pointed out to me, which I'd completely missed, Charlotte, there is a sort of a whole shtick going on about the first part of it being with scenery and the second part without scenery, which
well, that's
I
kind
wasn't
of hard to
of.
Convey in a rehearsed reading
without any scenery at all. Anyway, but the thing that I loved almost most of all was a complete surprise, which was an interactive sort of investigation, and it was at stage at the Central Library, where this Glasgow theatre company called Visible Fictions had staged a sort of detective trail around the library shelves, where you had to investigate the disappearance, the mysterious disappearance of a librarian.
And, that sounds cool.
Oh, it's so cool. You start off, again, it sort of relates a little bit to all these mazes and things. You start off with a code, and then you follow the Dewey codes around the library, and you find books which give you new codes, and it gives you journeys which are also stories. So there's one story which is about zombies, one story's about code breaking, another story's about the occult. In an hour, you have to come out with what happened to this disappeared librarian. And I have to say, it's going to be touring around all the schools of secondary schools of Scotland this year, and I just wish it would come down here, because I would definitely want to go and have another go at solving the crime better.
I have to say,
oh, we've got to get it down.
Yeah, I know.
So I missed this, and I'm so stupid. We have to lobby for it to come down. Sorry.
Well, I think everybody should lobby for it. And if you want to do so, it's called The Hidden, and it's by Visible Fictions. So get your request in now if you're a school in England.
That's awesome.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like, a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
You're listening to the Guardian Books podcast. Staying on classics of a different kind, so moving away from Ali Smith and Muriel Spark, we are now going to hear from Daisy Johnson and Michael Hughes talking about their novels. And we're starting with Daisy explaining her book, Everything Under.
Everything Under is set primarily on the canals around Oxford. And it is about a young woman who had a very troubled childhood. She had a very difficult mother, and she begins a journey to find her mother, and in doing so begins to remember what happened on the river when she was a child. It is a retelling of the Oedipus narrative with lots of gender swapping and strange threatening creatures. And yes,
we say it's the Oedipus narrative, but actually you don't declare that, and you have to get quite far through the novel before you begin to see exactly what's happening. And I just wondered what point you made that decision. I mean, the difficulty of writing a novel based on a well-known story is we know the ending.
And I think in the Oedipus narrative, the ending, you know, there's quite a lot of twists in there. We thought long and hard about whether, you know, does it change the reading experience to know beforehand? And I think people disagree on this, but I quite like knowing, because I think when I was reading Country, Michael's Country, looking for all the clues was one of the things I enjoy most about reading retellings, being like, oh, this is this and this is that. And yeah.
Yeah. Well, the young woman who you mentioned is called Gretel.
Yes.
Let's have a little bit of her. It's not all in one voice. You have different sections. Some are third person, some are first, but Gretel very much commands her own narrative.
Yes. So this is the beginning. There's a brief prologue and then I'll go into the first chapter. The places we are born come back. They disguise themselves as migraines, stomach aches, insomnia. They are the way we sometimes wake falling, fumbling for the bedside lamp, certain everything we've built has gone in the night. We become strangers to the places we are born. They would not recognise us, but we will always recognise them. They are marrow to us. They are bred into us. If we were turned inside out, there would be maps cut into the wrong side of our skin, just so we could find our way back. Except, cut wrong side into my skin are not canals and train tracks and a boat, but always you. The cottage. It is hard even now to know where to start. For you, memory is not a line, but a series of baffling circles, drawing in and then receding. At times, I come close to violence. If you were the woman you were 16 years ago, I think I could do it, beat the truth clean out of you. Now it is not possible. You are too old to beat anything out of. The memories flash like broken wine glasses in the dark and then are gone. There is a degeneration at work. You forget where you have left your shoes when they are on your feet. You look at me 5 or 6 times a day and ask who I am or tell me to get out, get out. You want to know how you got here, in my house. I tell you over and over. You forget your name or where the bathroom is. I start keeping clean underwear in the kitchen drawer with the cutlery. When I open the fridge, my laptop is in there, the phone, the television remote. You shout for me in the middle of the night, and when I come running, you ask me what I'm doing there. You are not Gretel, you say. My daughter Gretel was wild and beautiful. You are not her. Some mornings, you know exactly who we both are. You get out as many kitchen implements as you can fit on the counter and cook great breakfast feasts, 4 cloves of garlic in everything, as much cheese as possible. You order me around my own kitchen, tell me to do the washing up or clean the windows for God's sake. The decay comes on these days slowly. You forget a pan on the stove and burn the pancakes. The sink overflows onto the floor. A word becomes trapped in your mouth and you hack at it, trying and failing to spit it out. I run the bath for you and we go hand in hand up the stairs. These are small moments of peace, almost unbearable. If I really cared about you, I would put you in a home for your own good. Floral curtains, meals at the same time every day, others of your kind. Old people are a species all of their own. If I really still loved you, I would have left you where you were, not carted you here where the days are so short they are barely worth talking about, and where we endlessly excavate, exhume what should remain buried. Occasionally we find those old words sneaking back in and we are undone by them. It's as if nothing has ever changed, as if time doesn't mean a jot. We have gone back, and I am 13 years old, and you are my awful, wonderful, terrifying mother. We live on a boat on the river, and we have words that no one else does. We have a whole language all our own. You tell me that you can hear the water effing along. I answer that we are far from any river, but that sometimes I hear it too. You tell me you need me to leave, you need some sheesh time. I tell you that you are a harpy doodle and you grow enraged or laugh so hard you cry. One night I wake and you are screaming and screaming. I skid along the corridor, knock your door open, put on the light. You are sitting up in the narrow spare bed with the sheets pulled to your chin and your mouth open, weeping. What is it? What's wrong? You look at me. The Bonac is here, you say, and for a moment, because it is night and I am only just awake, I feel a rise of sickening panic. I shake it away. open the wardrobe and show you the empty inside, help you out of bed so we can crouch together and look beneath, stand at the window and peer out into the black. There's nothing there. You have to sleep now. It's here, you say. The Bonac is here.
So, what is the Bonac? Will you, you perhaps need to explain that?
I don't want to give too much away for people who are going to read the book, but so the Bonac is something that when Gretel was a child living on the river with her mother, began swimming upstream along the river towards them. And the closer it got, the more pets went missing and children start going missing. And part of Gretel's journey throughout the book is trying to remember exactly what this Bonac is and what it represents for her.
So one of the things that I think you get from that chapter is how it's very strange, but it's also very familiar. So you're talking about, in a way, you're talking about an Alzheimer's story, but you're also talking about the languages that mothers and daughters speak together and the languages that families develop over a lifetime together and the fear of that all slipping away.
Yes, that's something I started being really interested in when I was writing short stories, is this idea of making the familiar strange. And I think that's something that happens when you know someone as well as you know your family, is that you have these routines and these strange rituals and they become so familiar, they almost become otherworldly. And that's something I really wanted to explore, you know, something as simple as a mother-daughter relationship kind of spinning off into strangeness.
Mm. I really resonated incredibly strongly with that because I grew up in Africa and we used to have this word vulching. I vulch for it. And I once wrote it in an application for a job and I was they made an absolute mockery of me saying it can't exist. You can't write vulching. What does it mean? It doesn't work.
Yeah.
So, well, if you've ever lived in a place with vultures, you know exactly what vulching means. And there's a lot of river language in this novel, isn't there? Which is because that's very much the location that they share together.
Yes, and I really wanted to explore this idea of, so they come up with this language, just as you seem to do when you were younger, but it's a language that no one else in the world can understand. So when Gretel grows up and goes to school, she realises that by creating this language for her, mother has ultimately ostracised her from the rest of the world. And I really wanted to explore this idea that language, you know, can change our personality. I think the language that she uses when she's a child makes her a loner, makes her a recluse.
Mm-hmm. There's other figures apart from Sarah and the mother, who is the mother, and Gretel. There is a mysterious boy girl who, and I was thinking about this, how one talks about it without spoiling the plot. And then I was wondering whether one would spoil the plot.
Yes, there is another character in Gretel's childhood, a boy, I think, who she thinks is a boy, who comes one day walking into the place that their boat is moored. And her childhood is all tangled up with this idea of her growing sexuality, which is enmeshed with this character who turns up and who her mother has a slightly weird relationship with. And a lot of the novel is about finding out who this character is. And part of the novel, the third thread of the novel, is actually from their point of view. And I enjoyed writing that bit. I did.
So it's interesting you say from their point of view. So you're, as far as you're concerned, there are they.
I think it's interesting because there is quite a lot of transgender ideas in this book. For Marcus, this character, I think, is a character who wouldn't understand our contemporary language, you know, the very careful pronouns that we use now. It is a girl to begin with who then, I think, to protect themselves, becomes a boy in a sort of Shakespearean way, I imagine. But I think, I think maybe they are between genders, but I don't know what pronoun they would use. I'm struggling to talk about them.
it's really interesting, yeah. Because they are a very complicated composite. I mean, I've thought of Orlando in a way when I encountered them.
Yeah.
and I want to ask you a bit about the structure, because it is very, very, very strongly structured. It's like the structure is another voice of the novel. But it's little sections, very tight sections with very different vocabularies, very different, you know, some are third person, some are first person. How did you come up with that?
Through endless redrafting. So it took about 4 years to write this book, with the first draft being very, very quick. And then I really struggled to find, I knew that I wanted it to be a retelling of the Oedipus book, and I didn't know who was the best character to carry this story. So originally it was a lot more from the mother's point of view. And then I kept trying and moving around, and the section that I read from to begin with is from Gretel's point of view, but she's addressing her mother. And for me, that had to be that way because the mother is such a pivotal character in the book. You know, she's for Gretel, she is kind of everything. She's the way she made her the way she is. So I think she had to address her mother. And then a lot of the rest of the book is in other voices, but narrated by Gretel. So that even though it seems as if other characters might be speaking, actually it's Gretel narrating the story to us, I think, to the best of her ability. You know, she's narrating things that she wasn't even there for. And I think I also really wanted it, so it's obviously quite a literary book, but I wanted it to have pace. It's a story about her trying to find out something, which is, I think, is why it's in quite small sections, which I hope you move through quite fast. I think the second reason is that, so as you said, it's also about Alzheimer's, about what happens when you get older, and also about how sometimes we forget things to protect ourselves. So I wanted, as the reader is reading, I wanted them to have this sense of slight disorientation, of sort of fragments of images coming together, which I think is how the mother who has Alzheimer's is perceiving the world.
You said that it took you 4 years to write. You published your first book. This is actually not your first book, it's your first novel.
That's right.
So you published Fen, which is a collection of short stories, in 2016. So were you writing this before you were you published Fen?
So I had the idea for this before, and then did a couple of drafts and concentrated more on Fen, and then kept going back to this and kept despairing about this and crying about it. So yeah, it was sort of happening at the same time. And then after Fen was published, I was really concentrating just on this and redrafting this.
Right, now I'm going to park you and I'm going to turn to Michael, who's been waiting very patiently in front of his microphone. Michael, you have used the Iliad. You signal it in a more direct way by, for example, having a character called Achille. No prizes for guessing who that is.
Absolutely, Achilles. And that was one of the moments when the initial idea I had really, really came to life, when I lighted on Achille, which is an island off the west coast of Ireland, as a possible use of it, as a nickname for that character to use as an equivalent.
Oh, that's a brilliant coincidence, isn't it?
There were a couple of moments like that where things just clicked into place, stories I heard that resembled incidents in the Iliad. When, to begin with, this was just a notion, an idea, and it began to solidify as these various bits and pieces came to light and began to feel like, yes, this could actually work.
Mm. Now, again, it's a very strongly voiced novel. You're an actor.
That's
but
right.
you're actually called Michael Colgan. That's your acting name.
Yes, I use a different name as an actor. When you join the Actors Union Equity, you're not allowed to use a name that's already been registered. And unfortunately, someone's already registered the name Michael Hughes.
Yeah, so I imagine that there might be some pressure on that name.
Well,
in acting circles.
could be. So I had to take another family name, which Colgan was one. And it helps to separate your post, if nothing else.
Yeah, I was wondering whether it helped you to keep your head in two different places. Because being an actor, when you're up there and doing other people's work, and being a writer when you're sitting in your study doing your own writing, two very different activities.
They are indeed. And the reason I like to, one reason I like to keep them going in parallel is because acting is very, very social. You're constantly thrown together with new people, constantly in new places. And writing, apart from this side of it, which is very nice when you pop your head up out of your burrow every couple of years with a new book, is very, very solitary. You're carrying this whole world around just in your head. At least I am, because I don't really like people to read things until they're quite far down the line.
Now, I've been dying to ask you to read, obviously.
Sure.
I'm very interested to see what you make of it, because it is something that speaks with a very strong accent. And
I was very keen. I'm not a classical scholar of any kind, but I was very taken with the idea that the Iliad would initially have been received orally by its audience. It would have been read or spoken, recited aloud. And I was very keen to preserve that sense of orality and keep the sense of a story being told aloud in the voice I chose for the novel. So I'll read it just a bit from the very beginning, which opens it for those of you who know the Iliad in a very familiar way. Fury, pure fury. The blood was up, lost the head completely. Achille, the man from the West, the best sniper the IRA ever seen. All called him Achille, but his name was plain Liam O'Brien. After the Da, big Liam O'Brien, who came out of Achille Island and bore the name before him. So the son was called Achille in his turn, though he was born and reared in Castlebar, and he'd never set foot in the place, for the Da always said it was a fearful hole. What was the start of it? The whole wrecking match that sent so many strong souls roaring down to hell, dogs chewing up the guts ground into the road, birds pecking at the splattered bits of their brains. The way London wanted it to go. The way it always is. Here's what. Pig and Achille fell out. The OC and the trigger man. Bad, bad news. And whose fault was that? Here's who. one particular prod farmer from up the country, a man all knew as Crisis Cunningham, who owned the land where they were prepping the job that Pig had been renting since the ceasefire was called. 96 this was, the year just turned. The farmer motored down to get back his daughter, for the girl had disgraced him by running away and flinging herself at Pig, after he called in to settle his account the week before. She was shacked up now at his place, doing his washing, cooking his dinner, whatever else. So this man Cunningham sent word to Pig and his brother Dog, and he was told to come on down to the farm for a wee chat. The whole squad gathered to hear, round the side of the barn, ducked in under the jut of the roof in case a chopper went over, stamping away the cold, puffing into their hands. The old man said his piece, laid it all out. The whole recitation of his credentials and bona fides. No interest in politics of any colour or creed, you pays your money and no questions asked. But he knew better than to frig around with lads the like of them. He hadn't come empty-handed, no sir. A bag full of cash for Pig, big bundles of sterling 20s, English notes. The keys to his own merc. The promise of a prize bull, once the next season was done, worth 10 or 12 grand itself. Then it started. The man begged, he plain begged for the young one back, weeping and whining, down on his knees in the wet dung of the yard. She's hardly 14, the light of my life. Please don't touch her, big man, not yet a while. Give her a couple more years to be a wee girl. I buried her mother and my mother both this past year. The heart is already tore out of me. I can't stand losing the last bit of joy I have. Nobody knew where to look. It would scunder you to see a grown man like yon choking on his sobs and snotters. They all nudged other, and the mother went round. Go on there, Pig. Let the girl go back home with her da, and we'll have no more said about it. Not Pig. He laughed his big dirty laugh right in the poor man's face. Away and shite. I take no orders from muck savage orange bastards. The girl stays where she is, and she'll be doing my ironing and plenty besides till her pubes turn grey if I want her to. Now get the fuck out of this before you're carried out. He drew his short, snapped off the safety, and away the old man skedaddled, hoofing it down the back lane at a fair old lick. But the minute he got in home, he lifted the phone to a certain individual. You know I take no sides, he says, and I never ask for nothing. But family is family, and I bring in the vote for you here in the town land every election. So this one time, there's a wee favour you can maybe do for me.
So chilling, isn't it?
That it just gets that treachery. That sort of big concept of treachery, which goes all the way through classical epic. But
absolutely. And I think what really struck me as I read my way into the Iliad and got to grips with what that story was really how local it is, how small these groups of characters were. And again, that was something that inspired me or gave me permission to borrow it for my story. Northern Ireland's a very local place. People do know each other. Local allegiances are very important. Loyalty, betrayal, honour, those things are still very important, those emotions we see to the fore in the classical myths.
So now it's set in 1996. Yeah. Why that particular year? Because I always think of 1997 as the year when the ceasefire happened. But
yes, there was a first ceasefire, which was in 1994 and lasted about 18 months. It broke with the Canary Wharf bomb in I think it was February 1996. What I wanted to do, again, jumping from the model of the Iliad, I started out with the idea to write about the Northern Ireland conflict, and I'd been trying to write about that for quite a long time. When I decided to do it in this way, one of the reasons that felt appropriate is because you had two sides at the end of a long conflict, feeling exhausted, looking for a way out. But if I set it entirely in ceasefire times, the one part of the conflict that I'd be dodging is the violence. And that was the real thing I wanted to write about, that I felt was lacking in the attempts I'd made before. I really wanted to, for myself as much as for any reader or anything else, to try to think my way inside the people who are actually involved in the conflict. So for that to be the case, there had to be some fighting.
You grew up in Armagh, County Armagh.
I grew up in County Armagh,
which is a border.
Yeah, it's a border county, and I grew up towards the south of it in a town called Cady, which is about 5 miles from the border.
So this is sort of actually prime IRA country.
Just where I grew up is fairly quiet and would have been more of a moderate nationalist town, but you're certainly in the midst of that and on the edge of the area known as South Armagh, which is absolutely prime Republican heartland, yes.
And did you see this? Did you? I mean, obviously, it was in your childhood. All this stuff.
It was. I was born in 1972, which was often cited as the worst year of the troubles of the conflict. And I did. I grew up with it completely normal. At the top of the street I grew up in was a huge helicopter base. There were army patrols up and down the street all the time, and you couldn't drive the car for more than a few minutes without being stopped and have your details taken and so on. And that was completely normal to me in my childhood. It was only when I grew up and moved away that because I did I moved to England to go to university in the early 90s before the ceasefire. So that was really, although obviously I knew life wasn't like that beyond, that was my first taste of living in the way the rest of Britain and Europe were used to.
Mm. Your use of names interests me, because as well as Achill and Pig and Dog and yeah. They all have these wonderful names. Is that something that you've observed, or is that just something you decided to invent?
I think the last time I lived in Northern Ireland was really a sixth form. And in my school, nicknames were a very big thing, both for people, fellow students, and also for the teachers. Sometimes there'd be family nicknames, sometimes they'd be come up with a because of some incident that had happened or something. Sometimes they were even done to be the opposite of what the person represented, just as a sort of extra wind-up. And I know in the Iliad and in classical literature, these characters often have appellations: fleet-footed Achilles, flashing-eyed Athene. They have these extra little tags put onto their names, and I thought that was a nice correspondence I could play with as well.
Mm-hmm. I want to get back to the violence, mm-hmm. Because it's interesting, because it's like hand-to-hand violence. Even when there are guns involved, it's very close quarters. So it's not like sort of somebody shooting down a street. It's somebody shooting somebody they know, or kneecapping somebody.
Yeah, that's right. For those who haven't read the Iliad, it's wall-to-wall fighting. It's like a stupid 80s action movie. They're just people getting cut down left, right and centre, with incredibly gory deaths all around. And that doesn't fit in the Northern Ireland context. Those killings were often done at a distance, whether with bombs or sniper rifles. Occasionally people would walk right up to people and shoot them or kneecap them, as they say. To me, there's nothing romantic in the violence, but one of the central ideas I wanted to explore was the fact that for these people, there is. What they're doing is squalid and is nasty and is cruel and is horrible by any standards, but they think it's worthwhile. They think it's appropriate. Why? How do they get to that point? How do they find any romance, glamour, honour in those sorts of activities? That's really what I'm trying to dig into in this book.
Well, part of it is, and as you get through the book, you sort of teasing away at this idea of some sort of honour and nobility as being part of what they are all reaching for, and somehow having a feeling that by sacrificing themselves, they may be saving future generations from what they're going through.
You see, to me, I'm by instinct a pacifist. I'm not sure if I am philosophically or in practice, but I'm not a violent person. I've no interest, and when I was growing up in Northern Ireland, I absolutely despised the violence and those involved in it completely. I had no interest in any of that. I withdrew myself as much as possible from that. What I've had to do as I've got older is try to understand how this was going along, how it is that people, whether it's ancient Greece, mythological ancient Greece, where these characters, Agamemnon, Menelaus, feel themselves as full of honour and full of glory for going out and chopping people to bits with big swords in a completely squalid, cruel way. Is that honourable? Maybe it is in the right circumstances. And the same question applies to Irish republicanism, and also with the case with the British Army, although they have an official presence there. They're equally involved in violence and feel absolutely entitled to engage in that way. That's what an army is. The IRA see themselves as a legitimate army fighting a legitimate cause. And how is it that they can find glory and honour in that horror? That's the question for me.
And you have quite a sinister, you evoke what it is like to be turned against your own people and how you get drawn in. There's one particular character who ends up putting herself in debt to the local police and ends up being dragged into being an informer. So it's not all about the IRA.
It's really not. That character was very important to me for two reasons. I call her Nellie in the book. She's a rough equivalent to Helen in that she's the wife of one of the IRA men who ends up working as an informer and then separating herself from her background and going to, at least trying to get herself off to England. On the one hand, I wanted to give a sense of the wider world around outside the actual people involved in the conflict. But secondly, having decided that I wanted to get to that point with that Nellie slash Helen character, I started a how do I have a character who is the wife of an IRA man and ends up as an informer? That is absolutely almost impossible to square. So purely as an exercise, as a writer, I started writing my way into that. I think let's start way back when she's young and write my way into that situation, see if I can find a plausible. I'll often do that if I find myself in a corner. I'll just write my way out of it and then use what I need to. But that story took on a life of its own. And in the end, I thought, I'm putting that all in. Her whole story.
She's a great character.
Well, there's nothing, there's so little about Helen in the Iliad that that was another reason I wanted to do it, because it's such a heavily male story, as it is, although there were female members of the IRA and indeed plenty of female people involved on the British side as well. I really wanted to explore that side in a lot more depth.
Now, I want to open this out to both of you because I am interested in why there is so much adaptation of classical stories around at the moment. There are two on the Book Along list, yours and The Water Cure. Why do you think it is?
I've been thinking a lot about it, and I don't know, because I think there's been a lot around in the last couple of years, and they seem to have increased and increased, and this year in particular there are lots, and I don't know what it is about why we look back. For me, I think it's that the idea of, as Michael was saying, the idea of taking these stories, which are often very masculine and often have a lot of silenced characters in, and how we can rewrite them in a more interesting way. I love the idea of, you know, taking this story and destroying it and using the debris to build it in a different way and see. And I think also as a writer, it's just such a fascinating exercise I found, you know, like how, yeah, as you were saying about Helen, how can I make her do this? I really want to see her in this way. And, you know, playing around with things, I think I found really enjoyable. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think for me personally, it gave me a structure and an authority. The trouble with writing about the Northern Ireland conflict for someone who grew up there is that you're either going to end up fictionalizing or dramatizing real incidents, which is real people's pain that I have no business exploiting, or else you're going to end up making up incidents which never actually happened. And it's quite a self-contained conflict. Although it happened over a long period of time, the number of violent deaths is something around 3,000. Any one of those incidents contributed to making the whole thing what it was. If you go about making up things that never happened, I find that quite queasy territory. Using an existing mythic structure kind of lets me off the hook and lets me say to the reader, look, this isn't real. I'm not telling you about real events in Northern Ireland. I'm telling you, I'm trying to find something about the nature of violent conflict, and I'm using this story that we have available to us, that we all have available to us. And it's going to be fine. It'll still be there. Other people will do what they want with it. I just want today to take that story and wrestle it into submission as far as I can for my purposes, to allow me to say some things about this conflict that otherwise I would feel very uneasy with.
Oedipus is not only a historical story, but it's a part of analysis, psychoanalysis, hasn't it? I mean, it's so deeply entrenched in our culture. Is that part of what you were getting at with that?
Perhaps a little. I think certainly. So I think it was Sally Vickers who tried to, you know, take Oedipus away from Freud and say, actually, this is about how can a mother leave her child? How can someone be in that frame of mind? And I think that's the part I was really interested in, to create a character who could fit that, you know, who could actually maybe explainably leave her child and then the repercussions of that.
And the repercussions of that unnatural break between a child and a mother is all chaos, isn't it? And anything can happen if you don't know. I mean, the biggest taboos can get accidentally broken. I mean, there's an extraordinarily sort of emotional logic in that interpretation, I think, which comes out in the novel.
It was fun to write, I think. I think you're right. I think chaos. I enjoyed the chaos.
Chaos. And didn't they? These classical stories, both of these stories are about chaos. Partly.
They are about chaos. They're about wildness. And that's the other appeal. I, to tell you the truth, I had spent a couple of years trying to write a novel about Northern Ireland, about someone like me who came from a place like that and was coming back and trying to come to terms with what I'm going. And I was boring myself stupid writing it. So the poor reader, I had to chuck that out and find another way into it. And I wanted to find a way to do exactly that, to capture the wildness of it, the energy of it, the fury of it. and the chaos, and take the reader on a sort of a wild ride through that, through those characters and through those events.
I'm interested what you're going to do next, because after having harnessed these monsters of world literature, what are you going to go and now return to sort of the Moomins or something?
What are you working on next? Are you working on something at the moment?
I wouldn't say writing. I'm in the very early stages of trying to think about what I'll do next. I certainly, having written two novels now, which were quite a relatively dark, have a certain amount of violence in them, a certain amount of large scope, I would like to write something much more in the domestic realm, and much more self-contained, and maybe that'll be more more optimistic, or more optimistic's not the right word, but I'm not that person. Maybe that's where I get it out in the books, but I'm quite an up person, I'm quite a happy person, and I suppose I'd like to put a bit of that, especially in the last few years, my life has been much more domestic, and I suppose I usually find what I'm writing is dragging a few years behind where I am in my life, but maybe it's time for me to catch up with that.
Well, maybe it's something to do with being the father of a very small child, and so all this rage about being kept awake night after night
is
coming out in your writing.
We had a baby who wasn't sleeping very well through a large chunk of the writing of this novel. So someone did say to me early on, it's quite sort of dreamlike, isn't it? Nice. Well, funny that, because a lot of it was written when I hadn't had very much sleep.
Daisy.
So I am working on a horror novel at the moment, which I'm really enjoying. And I think, it was interesting after a retelling, because obviously the thing you have when you enter into working with a retelling is you have the structure already there. But equally with horror novels, you have all these kind of markers and pointers. I'm really enjoying it. And it's scaring me, so hopefully it will scare everyone.
Will you go back to short stories?
I always work on short stories. Being a child of the creative writing course, short stories was where I started. And I can't get enough of short stories.
Thank you very much, both of you.
That was Claire Armitstead talking to Daisy Johnson and Michael Hughes. Country is published by John Murray, and Everything Under is published by Jonathan Cape. Next week, the mathematician Dr. Eugenia Cheng comes into the studio to talk about logic and how mathematical principles can be applied to our everyday thinking. Meanwhile, you can subscribe and review us on all of your favourite podcatchers and join the discussion on Twitter by leaving a comment on the podcast page or emailing us on bookspodcast@theguardian.com. But for now, from me, Sian Kane, and our producer, Stuart Silver, goodbye and thank you for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.